Good evening. I'm pleased to welcome you to tonight's programme with Scotland's First Minister, Alex Salmond. Tonight's event is co-organised by the Commonwealth Club of California and the World Affairs Council of Northern California. My name is J. Dennis Bonney, and I'm associated with both organisations, the Commonwealth Club and the World Affairs Council, both of which I headed in the past. It's my honour and pleasure to introduce this evening's distinguished guest, Mr. Alex Salmond, First Minister of Scotland. Mr. Salmond was born in Linlithgow, Scotland, and attended Linlithgow Academy before studying at St. Andrews University. He graduated with a joint master's degree in economics and history. He entered the UK government in 1978 as an assistant economist in the Department of Agriculture and Fisheries for Scotland. In 1980, he went into the private sector and joined the Royal Bank of Scotland, where he worked for 7 years, first as an assistant economist before being appointed energy economist, and then in 1984, bank economist. He has also been a visiting professor of economics at Strathclyde University. He was elected a Member of Parliament for Banff and Buchan in 1987, and was elected National Convener for the Scottish National Party in 1990. He served as a leader of the opposition in the Scottish Parliament and then became the first Scottish National Party First Minister of Scotland on May 16, 2007. He's been re-elected. He was re-elected unopposed for a second term as First Minister in May 2011. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond, who will address us.
Well, Mr. Bonney, ladies and gentlemen, I should clarify that about being elected unopposed last year. There were other parties standing in the election. It was only unopposed once it got to the Parliament, but it was a vigorous democratic campaign with a very satisfactory outcome. But can I say thank you, Mr. Bonney, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club of California, which is the oldest and largest public affairs forum in the country. It's an honour to speak here as First Minister of Scotland. Now, Scotland and the United States share many ties of family, friendship, culture, ideas, trade, commerce. Woodrow Wilson, one of 23 United States presidents who could claim Scots or Scots-Irish descent, once remarked that every line of strength in American history is a line coloured with Scottish blood. And from time to time, various surveys have suggested, and I really love this figure, that suggests that almost 30 million people in these United States claim Scots or Scots-Irish ancestry. Although the official census figure is only around 10 million. And I just love that concept. You know, it means there's 20 million people across the United States who perhaps aren't officially Scottish but want to be Scottish. What greater compliment has ever been paid to any nation? So as far as we're concerned, with due deference to the official census figures of the United States, we'll settle for the 30 million and more. So I take it there's a huge compliment that so many millions of additional Americans are claiming links with Scotland. They're very, very welcome to do so. And incidentally, I think that number might increase after the launch of the film Brave, which was premiered in Los Angeles last night. It's the most fantastic collaboration between California and Scotland, with Disney Pixar's vision inspired by Scottish myths and landscapes and being realised with the help of a largely Scottish cast. It is an extraordinary film, and I commend it to you, ladies and gentlemen. You know, find some children to go with as an excuse. It's really quite scary. You know, not for the kids, the adults were the ones who were scared. But it's an amazing film, and does Scotland and proud, and well done to Disney and Pixar. The Scottish influence, of course, in California goes back a long way. The railroads, which did so much to open up the West, were to a huge extent funded by Scottish investment trusts. My wife is with me here in San Francisco, is paying homage tomorrow to John Muir from Dunbar, the great and far-sighted environmentalist, by visiting the National Preserve of Redwood Trees, named after him just north of where we are today. In Scotland, to celebrate the anniversary, we're planning a major extension to the John Muir Way. It will be a long-distance footpath starting near Dunbar to mark the centenary of Muir's death in 2014. Now, John Muir had a view, and that was encapsulated in a wonderful quote. John Muir said, "Everybody needs beauty as well as bread." And that's a fine expression, of course, of the need for sustainability. And the concern for the environment, of course, is one of the joint and shared concerns of California and Scotland, together with a passion, of course, for innovation and an internationalist outlook. One of the famous people from thereabouts who was proud of his Scots and Scots-Irish roots, of course, was John Steinbeck, born in Salinas, studied at Stanford, a Californian who was deeply proud of his ancestry. Famously, he used lines from Robert Burns' poem To a Mouse to title his fifth novel of Mice and Men. "But Moosey, that know thy lane, in proving foresight may be vain. The best laid schemes of mice and men aft gang agley, and leave us naught but grief and pain for promised joy." The Commonwealth Club of California was actually the first institution to recognise Steinbeck's talent, awarding a prize to his third novel in 1934. And I've traced a quote from Steinbeck that suggests he was less pleased by this than perhaps he should have been. He said, quote, "This is the first, and God willing, the last prize that I shall ever receive." Well, it wasn't perhaps the greatest forecast from John Steinbeck, because he went on to many, many more, including the Nobel Prize, of course, three decades later. In 1964, Steinbeck embarked on a correspondence with the recently widowed Jackie Kennedy. And it was a correspondence which has a fantastic exchange of letters. And in one of the letters, Jackie Kennedy writes to Steinbeck. Of course, she says, "Ireland, like Scotland, is a lost cause." And Steinbeck wrote back, "You talked of Scotland as a lost cause. That's not true. Scotland is a cause unwon." So tonight, I want to talk about the unwon cause. A wonderful way of putting it, and what I want to do this evening is to outline why the cause of Scotland, of independence for Scotland, is one which will be won when it's put to the people in a couple of years' time. In doing so, I'll make it clear that independence is the best way, in my estimation, of attacking other unwon causes which all governments must fight and fight continually, creating jobs, opportunities, delivering for the common weal of our people, promoting good international relations abroad. But first, I want to make a straightforward case. Scotland is a nation which has made a substantial contribution to the world and has a huge amount to offer the world in the future. And I think it's fair to say that that fact is increasingly recognised from businesses around the world. If Scotland were an independent nation, substantially due to our oil and gas reserves, we would have the sixth highest per capita gross domestic product in the OECD. That would still be behind the United States of America, you'd be believed to know, in fourth place. Indeed, California, if you separated out California, would be in third place, but ahead of the United Kingdom, which currently ranks 16th. Even if you discounted oil and gas, Scotland is the third most prosperous part of the United Kingdom after London and the southeast of England. Now, much of that success is based on innovation. Like California, our economy looks to the future. We have 5.2 million people in Scotland, a smaller population than the San Francisco Bay Area, a seventh of the population of California as a whole. Yet according to the Times Higher Educational Supplement, we have five universities in the world's top 200, even more per head of population than California, although I should say that California does have two out of the top three. We also rank first in the world in terms of research productivity per unit of GDP, second in the world in terms of research impact. Eric Schmidt, the chief executive of Google, spoke in Scotland last August, pointing out that he had personally invested in a number of Scottish computer science companies. I quite like that. When somebody says, I have personally invested in a number of companies, then I sort of sit up and take notice, rather more than you might just of a general good-natured forecast. And what Eric Schmidt said was, quote, many people don't know how strong the initiatives are in computer sciences in the Scottish universities. There's every reason to believe there'll be quite a renaissance here. And what Mr. Schmidt had noticed was the quality of work being done in areas such as informatics, optoelectronics, by leading Scottish universities and companies. Our life science research, of course, achieved global fame more than a decade ago now when the Roslin Institute cloned Dolly the sheep. If you visit the wonderful, and I do think you should, as often and as you possibly can, not just visit Scotland, but when you go as part of the Brave Tour, which we'll be launching shortly, then you should call into the National Museum of Scotland. It's absolutely fantastic. I mean, you've got the array of Scottish inventions. You have the Alexander Fleming's Nobel Prize for discovering penicillin. You've got James Watt's first steam engine. You've got John Logie Baird's first colour television, invented in 1932. And right alongside them, you've got Dolly the sheep. we are like number one in the world in terms of the impact of our life science research relative to our GDP. And the researchers, and this is an important point, have an extremely substantial tradition of working collaboratively with industry. You know, when I was a lad growing up in Linlithgow, I sort of stumbled across the fact that Scotland seemed to have invented a great number of things, invented the modern world, according to an American. We like quoting an American writer saying that, because we would like to have said it ourselves, but we like quoting the American. It sounds more modest. But when Herman said that Scotland had invented the modern world, he had an area of truth in it. And so when I was a boy growing up in Linlithgow, I found Scotland had invented all these things, because nobody actually told me why we'd invented all these things. You know, was it because we were more inventive than anyone else? And then when I got to think about it later in life, I realised that there was actually two aspects to it. One was the education system, which was superior to anything else, which educated more people. You know, the more people you educate, the more you'll invent. It increases the number of people who are able to invent things. But secondly, and equally importantly, in the 19th century in particular, Scotland had the most advanced capital markets in the world. And if you look at most, not all, but most of the great Scottish inventions, like the steam engine for that matter, or a range of others, then they were invented as part of an industrial process. And therefore, the collaboration of our researchers in life science with industry is part of a long-standing Scottish tradition, which sees innovation as part not just of an academic, but of an industrial process. One of the companies I'll be visiting in my stay tomorrow is LifeScan, a Californian company which employs more than 1,000 people in Scotland already. And many of them are conducting world-leading research on diabetes, one of the great diseases and afflictions of the modern era. So we have key strengths in Scotland in tourism, financial services, food and drink. In fact, one of Scotland's greatest inventions saw its exports increased by no less than 20% last year. Global whisky sales were worth $4.5 billion in 2011. I'm delighted to say, incidentally, the United States of America remains the top Scotch whisky market in the world, which is a tribute to the excellent taste and discretion of the citizens of these United States. But you have to watch out. You know, Brazil, Singapore are catching up. So, you know, So really what I'm saying to the Commonwealth Club is you must do your duty by drinking your full quota. Because I want the United States to stay in the world's number one. In the energy sector, in which our chairman this evening played a most distinguished role, Aberdeen is the largest centre in the world after Houston. Scotland has the ambition and potential to become the renewable energy powerhouse of the continent of Europe. The Scottish Government is committed to meeting business needs and works together in a coordinated way to support business. And finally and crucially, we can offer a great quality of life. The vibrant cities close to extraordinary landscapes. Like California, we recognise the importance of a good lifestyle in attracting skilled workers. Unlike California, we can't promise constant sunshine. Although I did some research today and found out that one comparison which might make up for the slight dearth in sunshine is the fact you can get a golf club membership, a quality golf club in Scotland, for 10% of the cost in this state of California. So it's not altogether surprising that we hear the news, and this is something of an exclusive since it's hot off the press in the last hour, that Ernst & Young carry out an annual business attractiveness survey, and the 2012 edition has just been released. And I'll read you some of the highlights. I'm tempted to read the whole thing. It's so fantastic. But basically, for the second year running, Scotland has outperformed every other part of the UK in generating employment from foreign direct investment. To quote the Ernst & Young, job creation is the true measure of a successful FDI strategy, and on this count, Scotland is currently winning hands down. What is impressive about the latest survey is it reflects our ambition that an increasing number of FDI and foreign direct investments into Scotland should be in research and development, which has been one of our long-standing aims. And there's evidence in this latest survey today that that is being successful. I suppose, given that the Scottish football team isn't performing at all, actually, at the present moment, but we have great hopes for the future. The fact that we're beating London in foreign direct investment just now gives us some compensation and satisfaction. The Foreign Direct Investment magazine this year ranked Edinburgh and Glasgow as first and second in Europe in its assessment of large cities of the future. And the list of international companies which have invested in Scotland very recently includes such great names as Amazon, Avalox, Ceridian, Dell, State Street, and many others. And, of course, they join huge Californian companies such as Hewlett-Packard, Oracle, Cisco, and Chevron, which have been based in Scotland for a considerable period of time. So one of the messages in this visit is we want more companies to join these successful companies building success in Scotland. So yesterday, the Scottish Development International, the Scottish Government's inward investment arm, it launched a marketing campaign to encourage more companies to invest in Scotland. I've written personally to 70 of California's largest companies to highlight how Scotland could benefit their business. That letter will be followed up with direct contact with our SDI team in California and in Glasgow. Now, our aim is to set out the fundamental strengths of the Scottish economy, our good quality of life, and to highlight other key facts. The business operating costs for quality businesses can be some 30% lower than in other parts of the United Kingdom. So the message is clear, Scotland is open for business, and the business of Scotland is business. Perhaps, however, the best example of Scotland's ambition, innovation and internationalism is what I was speaking about with Governor Brown today, is the work on climate change. In 2009, the Scottish Parliament unanimously passed the toughest climate change legislation in the world. We committed ourselves to a 42% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2020, an 80% reduction by 2050. Scotland is committed to producing enough energy from renewable resources by 2020 to meet all of our own electricity demand. The potential is certainly there. We have 10% of Europe's wave power resources, 25% of offshore wind and tidal power resources, which isn't too bad for a country with 1% of the European Union's population. And as an international statement of our ambition in marine energy, we've established the $15 million Saltire Prize, one of the largest commercial challenge prizes in the world, in conjunction with National Geographic. The first time that the world's greatest educational charity has allied itself with a government. We've received some 150 expressions of interest from more than 30 countries, a growing number of declared competitors in that position. We now have a situation where the European Marine Energy Centre, which is based in the Orkney Islands, is the world's only fully accredited test facility for grid-connected wave and tidal converters, where Glasgow is the leading European base for offshore wind research, and where Strathclyde University's Technology and Innovation Centre is a £100 million hub for thousands of researchers and industry to work together in pioneering this technology. In fact, there are now more working wave and tidal devices in the waters around Scotland than in the rest of the world put together. So it's an area of huge interest, investment and potential for the future of Scotland. All 12 of Scotland's universities have formed the Energy Technology Partnership. Earlier this year, we signed a collaboration with Abu Dhabi's prestigious Masdar Energy Institute. I read recently about the origins of California's Silicon Valley. Much of the credit for that extraordinary growth is often given to Frederick Terman. And one of his great contributions as Dean of Engineering at Stanford University was to expand the university's capability in high technology sectors. Looking back on that remarkable growth in his later years, Terman reflected that, quote, "When we set out to create a community of technical scholars in Silicon Valley, there wasn't much there, and the rest of the world looked awfully big. Now a lot of the world is here in Silicon Valley." I'd like something similar to happen in Scotland. When planning for the European Marine Energy Centre started around a decade ago, it was hard to see if it was going to be successful at all. Viewed from the islands of Orkney, off the northern coast of Scotland, the rest of the world doesn't look awfully big. It can look also awfully far away. But at the moment, in that perhaps unlikely sphere, we have now achieved the position I mentioned a few seconds ago, when there are more different types of wave and tidal devices in the waters around the Orkney Islands in Scotland than in the rest of the world combined. The Pentland Firth is now the world's largest commercial-scale marine energy site. An independent report from Scottish Renewables estimated there had been more than £1 billion of investment in the renewable sector in Scotland during the previous year. Professor Ian Bryden of Robert Gordon University in Aberdeen coined the phrase that Scotland's Pentland Firth was the, quote, "Saudi Arabia of tidal power," because of the vast potential resource that its currents contain. So I'd say that in terms of technological development, Scotland is becoming the Silicon Valley of marine energy worldwide. And having been at the heart of the marine engineering revolution in the 19th century, at one point making some quarter of the world's shipping, we are now placing ourselves at the heart of the marine engineering revolution of the 21st century. The marine engineering revolution, which is going to engineer and design and develop, install and maintain and service the great machines which are going to power much of the energy needs of the coming century. So as you have gathered, we would say there are few parts in the world which have the level of ambition in their plans for renewable energy as Scotland has, but California is one such place. California's renewable energy target of meeting 33% of electricity consumption by 2020 is the most ambitious of any state in the United States. The 80% target for reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 matches Scotland's exactly. Like Scotland, you have a political consensus behind your targets. Actions started by Governor Schwarzenegger are being maintained and built on by Governor Brown. Now, in this situation, of course, Scotland tries to do what it can to promote international consensus, and that's particularly important with the summit in Rio starting tomorrow. And so we thought to ourselves, how could we influence world leaders to be as far-sighted as the present and immediate past governor of California? And so just after the Copenhagen summit a few years ago, we devised a 2020 whiskey. 42% proof. Which goes to those countries and those world leaders who are willing to commit themselves to the 42% target by 2020. I'm delighted to tell you that one of the few politicians in the world who now has a bottle of that whiskey is Governor Jerry Brown, and I presented it to him this very morning in Sacramento. I know that Angela Merkel is desperate to get her hands on a bottle. But I've made it absolutely clear to Germany that the 40% target is not enough. They have to go all the way to 42% before that bottle of whiskey can be theirs. There's a serious, hugely serious point in all of this that Governor Brown and myself were discussing. That a time when, you know, international financial storm clouds are not just gathered but burst upon us, and where the recovery seems elusive, and where there are a whole range of areas that are required, and where every single one of us, I suspect, economists, non-economists, human beings as well, you know, find the frustration of not seeing the degree of action and joint concern that is demanded by circumstances. It is the understandable pressure for people to take their eyes off the climate change ball, to say, well, the immediate pressures of a world recession, a financial collapse, the difficulties in rebuilding confidence in financial structures are such that surely the issues of climate change and greenhouse gases somehow seem very distant. But ladies and gentlemen, they are not distant. They are very immediate. And many, many places in the world are already feeling their dramatic effects. And therefore, despite everything, it's my view, it's the view of your governor, that we have to set that steady course in terms of having the ambition to tackle a fundamental challenge to the safety and future of this planet, as well as dealing with the immediate international financial crisis. California, Scotland, I think, can contribute a huge amount to the technologies which tackle climate change. And Governor Brown and I have agreed today to set up a working party of officials from our administrations to work on that very point. If you think about the communication revolution of the 20th and 21st centuries, some of the most important early developments, the telephone, the television, the fax machine, were developed in Scotland. But a massive proportion of the revolutionary recent technologies in programming, internet search, tablet computers, social networking have been developed here in the west coast of America. Now, my belief and hope is that Scotland and California can use that appetite for invention to tackle what may be the most important technological challenge of the 21st century, how we manage that transition to a low-carbon economy. And as developed countries succeed in making these technological breakthroughs, as we shall, in bringing the costs of green energy production into line with market realities, I believe it's important that we recognise our obligation to help the developing world grow in an environmentally sustainable manner. Earlier this month, I launched Scotland's Climate Justice Fund, together with Mary Robinson, the former President of Ireland, and the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. That is a cause in which I've taken to as many places as possible, and I know that we find a willing audience here in California. Now, all of these run through Scotland's economic strengths, advantages, highlights, things we do well, things we have done well, our track record of innovation, our contribution to world development, our wish to seek an alliance and friendship with other interested parties, some of the answers to the problems which beset this planet, raises a hugely interesting question. If Scotland is able to try and hopefully to succeed in showing global leadership on one of the most significant environmental, economic and moral issues facing the planet, that of climate change, why on earth shouldn't we have control of our own taxes, welfare system, and foreign policy. I noticed that Paul Krugman, when he spoke to this club last month, was scathing about the European response or lack of response to promoting economic recovery. Here in Scotland, we are seriously affected by the excessive austerity of the UK government's tax and spending policies, of which Paul Krugman spoke. We've actually made a pretty fair fist of supporting growth in hugely difficult circumstances. The recession in Scotland was not as deep or as long as elsewhere in the United Kingdom. But right now we are promoting recovery with one hand tied behind our backs. We can't adjust tax rate, we can't borrow prudently even for capital investment to invest in infrastructure. And a point of agreement as governments internationally focus on the necessity for a growth strategy should surely be that capital investment in key projects and infrastructure and increasing the capacity, the productive capacity of a country is a fundamental difference to revenue spending and the necessity for bringing revenue budgets into line with reality. That capital spending is of huge importance, whether it be private sector, public sector, in terms of maintaining, and at a time, of course, where many, many private companies, through lack of confidence, are amassing large quantities of capital, the public sector has a substantial role in leading infrastructure investment. So these positions that we have, the things that we cannot do in Scotland at the present moment, of course, have a direct effect. I mean, they have an effect on the opportunities for our young people, the welfare of our most vulnerable members of our society, and therefore it is of not just irritation but huge frustration that the Scottish Government do not have the ability and power at the present moment to meet these human needs with decisive action. What's the simplest encapsulation of the case for independence? I think the simplest encapsulation is this: that the people best placed to make decisions about Scotland's future are those who choose to live and work in Scotland. Nobody, but nobody, will care more about the welfare and benefit and the common weal of the Scottish people than those who live and work in Scotland. And that belief is at the centre of a civic, inclusive case that we're putting forward for independence. Scottish independence and the cause of independence is not based on where people come from. It's based on where we're going together as a country. Now, as America has done for many generations, including for many, many millions of Scots, we are proud to extend a welcome for those who choose to call Scotland their home. And it follows from the fact that we are very much at ease with the reality that nations are both independent and interdependent. Internationalism is part of our DNA, something that any Californian should understand full well. An independent Scotland would be an active member of the international community, would be a member of the United Nations, the European Union. We would still share a currency union with the remaining members of the United Kingdom. We would cooperate closely with nations from around the world. And of course, we would remain close friends of nations, such as the United States, with which we have such a long-lasting ties of trade, of family, of friendship. The United States will remain our biggest trading partner, our biggest foreign investor, and the biggest tourism market outside of the current United Kingdom. The United Kingdom currently is an incorporating union. And the difficulty of an incorporating union is that one nation, by virtue of size, will always prevail in policy decisions over the others. I think it's an anachronism in the modern age. When the United Nations was founded, it had 51 member countries. Now there are almost 200. As recently as 1990, Europe had 35 countries, now it has 50. Of the 27 countries which currently make up the European Union, six of them didn't exist as independent states before 1990. And independence, with the right to participate as an equal on the international stage, appears more and more like Scotland's normal and natural state of being. Now, that's why I believe as First Minister that Scotland will choose to be independent in 2014. With greater powers, we could do more to improve the prosperity and well-being of our people. We would re-enter the community of nations on a basis of equality, responsibility, and friendship. We would fulfil our duties as a good global citizen. Or as Thomas Jefferson said, we are a people capable of self-government and worthy of it. Or to finally quote Scotland's Bard Robert Burns, for all that and all that, it's coming yet for all that. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex Salmond, First Minister of Scotland, for that wide-ranging discussion. We have a number of Scots here today, as you may have noted as you came in, and many overseas Scots, including one who identifies himself as an exporter of Scotch whisky in the U.S., so there are many people who relate to what you were saying about the new brand of Scotch. But the interest... This question says, given the keen interest of many overseas Scots, many here tonight, on the most important constitutional event in 300 years, as you put it, what is the reason why overseas voters will not be permitted to vote in the 2014 independence referendum?
It's more a question of practicality than anything else. The voters' role, the proposal, which is actually a shared view of both the Scottish and UK governments, is that the register that should be applied is the one that elects the Scottish Parliament, that is, people resident in Scotland with an allowance for the armed forces. If we opened up the register to overseas voters, we would be in a conundrum of having a potential extension of the register to many, many people from Scotland who... were resident worldwide, including, as I said, potentially tens of millions of Scots worldwide, but also huge numbers of people in England and elsewhere. It would be, I think, difficult in a practical sense to do that and find out where the register should stop. And secondly, of course, the determination of a decision on self-determination should, in my view, be made by the people who are resident in the country who've staked their life chances on the country. It would be lovely, incidentally, to open up the voting register to the some 80 million Scots worldwide. And incidentally, I think it would be quite helpful to the independence cause, as it happens. However, at the end of the day, I think we have to have the register which voted to establish the Scottish Parliament in 1997 and the register which is domiciled in the country. However, if I could say to your questioner, you've also been... We're giving plenty of notice. And you have approximately 2 years to get back to Scotland in time to get on the register.
Well, there's a supplementary question. Then, do you really seriously expect a wave of repatriation of Scots from all around the world to do that?
I think there'll be some. One of the the declarations to that effect was at the launch quite recently of the Yes Scotland campaign, which goes beyond the SNP. It goes beyond parties. And that was the actor Alan Cumming. I suppose most famous in the United States for The Good Wife, the series The Good Wife. Alan is currently playing Macbeth. Actually, he's doing more than playing Macbeth. He's playing Macbeth and Lady Macbeth and every other character in Macbeth in a new special production in Glasgow at the present moment, which certainly sounds very demanding. But Alan, of course, is an actor of enormous talent. But one of the points he made, that he would be returning to domicile in Scotland in order to vote in the referendum. So whether it's a flood or a trickle or whatever it is, then I think a number of people will do that. Incidentally, I think an even larger number of people will return to Scotland after independence in order to play a part in the emerging independent country. I have a very... How shall I put it? Expansive view of Scottishness. I mean, my view of Scottishness is that it's anybody who stays in Scotland, anybody who is of Scots ancestry, anybody who has an affinity with Scotland. Basically, you have to kind of opt out in order not to be part of my Scottish family. But I think when it comes to the electoral decision, it'll have to be made on an electoral roll of people resident in Scotland at the time of the run-up to the referendum.
That being said, what is the best way to get to support the SNP? And if I want to be a candidate, how do I do it?
Well, the sort of fundamental prerequisite is to join the party. You know, it's unusual for political parties to have candidates who are not members. Not unknown, incidentally, but unusual. But in terms of people who want to return to Scotland and to be active in politics, and then great. You know, the more the merrier, the more the better. In terms of supporting Scotland, it's not really a financial thing. We have. You know, we have strict limits, and I think we're arguing in the referendum campaign, incidentally, that the financial contribution should be limited to £500 sterling and less for people out with Scotland. I think that's, the United States, which I love dearly, but has more experience than most countries of the dangers of big money dominating politics. But so you can today under £500 sterling, but more I think to spread the message about why Scotland has aspirations to become an independent country, that the sort of independence we would like to deploy, the strengths and the weaknesses we have as a country, and our hopes and beliefs that we can offer something. Something special, I hope, to the world in terms of how we deploy our resources and our skills and our technology and our ideas. I think, above all, our ideas, in terms of areas of huge importance, like the one I mentioned of renewable energy.
Still related question. What is the view of Scottish independence in Washington?
Well, I hope totally neutral. we find our relations with the United States government are very good, they're very strong. We don't expect the United States government to adopt a position on the constitutional affairs of Scotland, nor do they. And that's the right and proper way. I think when I come to the United States, sometimes people interpret from what I say where I might stand or in the United States, but I'm extremely careful not to to say anything which might be considered partisan between the political parties, and that's a sensible view and attitude. But we find we have great cooperation. I'm doing the 4th of July speech at the Consul General's leaving due. Unfortunately, Dana Linnett's leaving us. He's been a highly successful Consul General in Edinburgh, and the 4th of July celebration will be her climax of her diplomatic term. So I'll be doing the speech and thanking her for her contribution to American Scottish relations.
Next question is about the actual referendum, if that's the right word. Are you and the SNP committed to a straight yes-no for independence, or can you see circumstances where a third option, Devo Max, you might explain that, may present itself? This might be a huge step towards independence that may be more popular. Would anything be lost by presenting such an option?
I should explain to the wider audience that Devo Max is not Pepsi Max. It's it's something different entirely. There is a body of opinion in Scotland that clearly there's a body of opinion who are against further constitutional change. And that basically encapsulates the position of the Westminster parties, certainly the Labour and Conservative parties. They have dissenting elements within them, but nonetheless that's the predominant view. There is the view of the SNP and the Green Party in Scotland and a number of independents in the Parliament that Scotland should become an independent country. Scotland should be an independent country. There's also a view abroad in Scotland that perhaps it would be better from where we are now, which, let's say in fiscal terms, because this is basically a fiscal argument in this, where we now control about 16% of Scotland's revenue base, that rather than become an independent country, at least in the first stage, that fiscal base should increase to something near 100%. And that's often called Devo Max or fiscal autonomy or fiscal responsibility. And it's a very attractive argument, incidentally. It has a major problem, and that is that the United Kingdom government while they respect the right and the ability of Scots to decide on independence, are not prepared to accept the right of the Scottish people to decide on Dave O'Max. Their argument is a constitutional one. It has some constitutional merit, but it's not a very good political one, and that is they argue that the question of independence can be determined by the people of Scotland. The question of changing the financial rules within the United Kingdom could only be determined by the Parliament of Westminster. And given the Parliament of Westminster doesn't have the appetite to do that, they say that Dave O'Max should not be on the ballot paper. My position is a bit different from that. My concern as First Minister of Scotland is to make sure the independence question is on the ballot paper and fairly asked. That's the key reason I got elected. But I'm open to persuasion that there should be a second question, as it's called. So people should be asked, do you want independence? And if it's not an answer to yes, would you like fiscal autonomy or Dave O'Max for fiscal responsibility? And we currently are considering the returns in a major consultation exercise that we've held. We launched in January on this very point and other points related to the independence referendum. We had some 22,000 responses. And once we've analysed these, we'll be able to take a firm position. So my position is the independence question must be on the ballot paper. The UK's government's position is they've set their face against a second question. And we'll have to see what the negotiations turn up within the next few months. I suspect if I came back to the Commonwealth Club next year at this time, while I wouldn't be able to tell you the result of the referendum in 2014, I would at least be able to tell you the result of whether there will be one or two questions and also what that question will be.
Well, we certainly hope you will come back and keep us posted. You mentioned taxes and you mentioned fiscal structure several times. Do you plan to increase taxes, if Scotland becomes an independent nation? If so, you may have a hard time winning the vote. That's what this questioner says.
Well, no politician, no sensible politician, seeks to increase taxes for no reason. And our plan and programme has tended to focus on tax reduction to stimulate investment. I mean, for example, we favour a reduction, as I was discussing with Reuters in Los Angeles a couple of days ago, of corporation tax from the UK level of about 23% to 20%. Because we see that as a means of attracting not just business and investment, but headquarters, research and development, business investment, investments which are attracted by having an edge in corporation tax. It's an important economic tool, particularly for a small economy, to offer an edge in these terms. So in terms of business tax, we've tended to favour lower tax. This is something we've done with small business in Scotland, which is an area, one of the few areas of taxation which we control at the present moment, and the small business taxation is hugely better in Scotland and more beneficial than elsewhere in the United Kingdom. I'm less enthusiastic, and certainly I would not have reduced income tax as the Chancellor of the Exchequer did on the richer, most prosperous sections of the community. I think that's a very, very difficult decision to defend at a time of austerity when you're asking people to accept sacrifices across the community. So I suppose the SNP line is what's called a social democratic line. That is to say, we favour competitive business conditions because we believe that the best way to economic recovery and to secure public services is to have a competitive business environment that generates wealth both in the corporate sector and in the wages and salaries paid by the corporate sector to individuals. But we also favour a taxation structure that gives a reality to the claim that we're all in this together, where all members of the community can look at a taxation structure and say that's fair and balanced. That attitude to taxation, incidentally, is one which, if you look at it closely enough, you'll find justification in Adam Smith. It's not always how Adam Smith is quoted, but if you look at the theory of moral sentiments and the wealth of nations closely, you'll find the argument that taxation structure has to reflect both a competitive business environment and to make wealth creation possible, but also there is a responsibility in government to show empathy and to demonstrate community empathy and the commonweal. So that balance of taxation would be the one we'd pursue. We've tried to pursue with our limited taxation powers at the present moment, and it's what we'd pursue with the more extensive powers of an independent country.
I just want to interrupt the flow of questions for a moment to remind our radio audience that our speaker tonight is Mr. Alex Salmond, First Minister of Scotland. Could you expand on the economic conditions in Scotland, and particularly in the light of the banking problems that we read so much about 2 or 3 years ago?
Well, like most of the Western world, I mean, Scotland is still emerging from a recession of which, the like of which we haven't seen for 70 years. And financial recessions, history teaches and economics teaches as well, are more difficult to recover from because they aim at the structure of the financial system and makes it very difficult to sustain a flow of finance to business investment. It also leads to the current position we have in many of the Western economies where, although the corporate sector has accumulated large balances, there's a lack of confidence in the sector in terms of across sectors in terms of investment, and therefore provides challenges for policymakers in realising that there is a strong case for capital investment from the public sector, because if you try and do it from monetary policy alone, it's like in the old Keynesian analogy, it's like pushing on a piece of string. It has little effect because you have plenty of available capital and liquidity, but few takers who want to make investments. Scotland's had a slightly better time through the recession than the UK as a whole. We are arguing very strongly, while we support monetary policy initiatives, we're arguing very strongly they have to be backed up by capital investment fiscally. We set out in a paper some ideas we had a couple of weeks ago for our friends and partners across the European Union and how they might look at the tensions within the euro area and find a way to reconcile what is a very difficult question, because the essential difficulty in the euro area is it's a single currency for economies which can vary from the Ruhr Valley to the southern tip of Greece. In other words, have a huge difference in productivity between them, maybe 40%. So we have, as policymakers, no shortage of challenges to look at, but we believe that some of the things we're doing are having a substantial effect. We've done as far as we can do, and we have more to do in terms of protecting capital investment in Scotland, even within the structures that we find so difficult at the present moment, and the success in foreign direct investment, which I cited earlier in my speech, is an example of how if you target the industries and the type of investments, and you drive hard at them, and you've got a competitive offering to make in terms of the quality and skills of the people and the opportunity for the investment in the business, then even in the current business environment, you can have spectacular successes. And we have had some spectacular successes in direct investment in the last 2 or 3 years. Lastly, I would say that this environment, then, the emphasis on a resource base for business activity becomes all the more important. Why? If you take, for example, the energy field, most people understand in the business you were in, sir, that in the oil and gas industry, that oil is going to be required for some considerable time to come at substantial prices. In renewable energy, there's a realisation that there's going to be a huge demand for low-carbon electricity. So if you look at the resource-based industries where people can see an indication of substantial continuing demand, and these are the best areas to concentrate economic targeted efforts on, and we've had some success in doing that.
A member of our audience would like you to compare or contrast the Scottish and the Irish independent movements, and you might elaborate on that, compare the economic climate in Ireland, which we read about, is very negative compared with the positive description, you gave of Scotland.
Well, the question was wider than that, because Ireland's experience historically was quite different to Scotland's. Ireland suffered some considerable centuries of great suffering, and therefore the early 20th century move to independence came about in quite different circumstances. Scotland is not an oppressed country, never has been. I mean, we are a country who has freedom of choice in terms of democratic elections, in terms of what our future should be, and that's our absolute prized possession. Many, many countries in the world don't have that. One of the things as leader of the SNP I'm most proud of is that the national movement in Scotland has been in a serious political sense around for the best part of a century. Through campaigns for home rule, through the achievement and resumption of a parliament back in Scotland in 1999, to the present position where we have an independence party which leads a PR parliament in a majority. And in that entire century of petitioning, of lobbying, of campaigning, of referendum, not a single person has lost their life arguing for or against Scottish independence. Nobody's had so much as a nosebleed. And that is a huge and important thing in the modern world. Now, I understand the advantages that Scots and Scotland have had in this because we've had a democratic ballot box in order to express our ambition. But nonetheless, we're kind of proud of the fact that's how we've conducted our affairs. And it would be quite nice for politics and perhaps a good lesson internationally if the nice people would end up winning. I think it might be a lesson for elsewhere. So Scotland isn't Ireland. Ireland isn't Scotland. There's no direct comparison in the countries. In terms of recent economy, I wouldn't get too depressed about Ireland. I mean, Ireland, like America and like the United Kingdom, made a huge mistake of not regulating its financial sector to any sensible degree and paid a very, very heavy price. The Irish people have paid a huge price for that. The reason I'd be optimistic about Ireland is, unlike some of the other economies in the Eurozone, which are under huge, substantial pressure at the present moment, the underlying productivity in the Irish economy is very strong. Ireland's export performance is extraordinary at the present moment and very, very substantial. So it gives Ireland a strong base for recovery, in which other economies in the Eurozone area don't have the same advantage. So for all the difficulties that Ireland has faced and the austerity which has been visited upon its people, then I think there is a substantial reason to believe that Ireland will stage a good recovery because of the underlying strengths in its economy.
Is there a similar movement for independence in Wales?
There is a movement for a greater power for Wales. It's not and independence. It's not as strong as in Scotland. Again, Wales and Scotland have very different histories. But there's certainly an aspiration, and Wales is most certainly a nation that has a very powerful and national identity. The political side of that, I mean, Wales has a National Assembly which was established in 1999 at the same time as the Scottish Parliament was established. That National Assembly in Wales has grown in power. It hadn't the same level of power as the Scottish Parliament. It wasn't a legislative assembly, but now has some legislative powers, and I would expect its powers to grow over time. But the demand in the campaign for independence has not been as pronounced in Wales as it is in Scotland.
One question we'd like us to turn to...
You're doing an extraordinary job, sir, sorting out all these ballot papers. It's fantastic.
Our audience is so well informed and so interested in the subject that it's not at all difficult. It's an embarrassment of riches. The next question I think we'd like to turn to is military policy and military strength. How would an independent Scotland manage its security, national security issues?
Well, I think very well. We have no inconsiderable military tradition in Scotland. If I could commend to this audience a superb book written by Senator Jim Webb, called Born Fighting, which is a book about the Scots and Scots-Irish influence in American history and American politics. It's both in Scotland and in America, it's not often that politicians write very good books. And Jim Webb has written an excellent book. I think, to be fair, before he became a senator, he probably didn't have the same amount of time since he became a senator. But it's an excellent book which should be read, and it talks a great deal about the Scots military tradition. So we have a what you do and what you have in terms of a country of 5 million people, of course, is fundamentally different from the role that that Scotland plays within the United Kingdom. We would seek to be, in our policy just now, a member of Partner for Peace. That's the NATO extension organisation, which Ireland, Sweden, Finland are in at the present moment. We seek to cooperate with our friends and allies. We don't want to disrupt arrangements. We have plans for an effective conventional forces in Scotland, which would be more than enough to defend our immediate assets and interests. The one area of major central concern we'd have in Scotland, Scotland would be emerging as an independent country of just over 5 million people. There would be no argument or logic in stationing nuclear weapons in a country of that size. You know, we have 200 countries in the world, about, depending on how you estimate it, perhaps 10, perhaps a dozen have access to nuclear weapons technology. So I think we'd like to be one of the 190 which doesn't have nuclear weapons, as opposed to the 10 that has. There'd be no sensible argument for a country of Scotland's size adding to nuclear proliferation.
This questioner read your comment in the opinion column in the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle, referring to unjust wars, and I'd like to ask you to elaborate upon that, particularly in view of what you said about the very strong and prominent presence of Scottish fighters in World War I, World War II, Korea, the Falklands, and many other wars.
I was actually referring to the one that wasn't mentioned in that list, which was the war in Iraq, which was a completely unjust and, in my view, an illegal conflict. When countries have a substantial fighting tradition, whether they're the United States of America or Scotland or any other country, then politicians have a particular responsibility not to abuse the excellence and bravery and commitment of the armed forces. And in my estimation, the war in Iraq was an example of that abuse. It's an opinion I share with the President of the United States of America, so perhaps it's not as controversial here as it might have been a few years ago. But it's also one I share with Senator Jim Webb, who I quoted a few seconds ago. So particularly I was referring to the war in Iraq. I think the impact and the consequences of that conflict will be with us for generations to come. I think it weakened, resources in terms of Western treasure. It certainly sacrificed many lives in terms of our own armed forces and other people who died in the conflict. But above all, it weakened the moral authority. More than any other factor, that weakened moral authority in terms of how international conflicts, on what basis they should be pursued and what basis they must be conducted and determined on positions. So I was referring to the example which wasn't cited in the question.
Mr. Salmon, we have time for only one more question. Who would be the head of state in Scotland after independence?
Well, there's been a few suggestions. I mean, Sean Connery is right up there as a... But our position is Her Majesty the Queen would be head of state of the independent country. Rather important to recognise and realise that Her Majesty is Queen of not just England or the United Kingdom. She's Queen of 16 countries worldwide. She's head of state and monarch of Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and a range of other countries. I should say, since I've used Arthur Herman's book to claim ownership and authorship of much of the modern world, I should also point out that Her Majesty the Queen lineage was also a Scottish of Scottish origin. In fact, there was 100 years where Scotland and England had the same monarch, but were independent countries between 1603 and 1707. So our policy is to bring Scotland as an independent nation, but not to undo the Treaty of 1603, which established the common monarchy. There is another aspect to this. The we want to be an independent country. We want to determine our own affairs. We want to conduct ourselves responsibly as an international citizen. We want to make a difference in the world, hopefully be a force for good. We want to have the levers and powers to revive our economy and to help our people and to pursue the politics as we judge they should be pursued. But we don't want to break the social ties that we have with other countries of the United Kingdom. We want family and friends to have the same ability to be exactly that at the present moment. And, of course, the monarchy does represent part of that social union. The monarchy is part of the shared history. Now, we don't want to turn our back on a shared history either. We want to have a distinctive, independent future. So it's not just claiming the fact that, after all, it's Scotland's monarchy. Her Majesty the Queen, Queen Elizabeth, is Queen of Scots. But also it's part of a fabric and a social union that we want to maintain as we develop the political and economic independence which we think will add to the common weal of Scotland. So despite the prospects of Sean Connery, the answer is Elizabeth, Queen of Scots.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Salmon, First Minister of Scotland, for your comment today. I'd also like to warmly thank our audience for all the wonderful questions and also thank the radio audience for their attention and the Internet. We're on Internet. My name is Dennis Bonney, your moderator, and this meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.